A few months ago, a friend recommended I read a leadership book called Fast. I did that and enjoyed it so much that a couple of weeks later, I managed to get an hour of the author's time on Skype to pick his brains. He was very kind, considering we'd confused the time zones and it was 6 a.m. his time, and I got him out of bed. That author is Gordon Treadgold. Gordon is a leadership speaker, author, coach, and consultant for companies such as Accenture, AT&T, IBM, and many more. He writes for Inc. magazine, The Huffington Post, Business Insider, and is prolific across social media too, with 170,000 followers on Twitter. He's a fellow of the Institute of Leadership and Management, and yet still one of those down-to-earth natural leaders who quickly energizes people. His approaches are simple and practical to implement, yet highly effective. And he's going to share some of those with us today. We'll keep the webinar to an hour. Please submit your questions in the chat window on the right, and Gordon will do his best to answer them during the Q&A at the end of each topic. I'll now hand you over to Gordon Treadgold at West Palm Beach in Florida. Gordon.
Hi, everybody. Very happy to be on the webinar and to share with you my fast leadership approach. And we're going to cover each of the four letters of FAST, and we'll give you an opportunity to ask some questions after each of those lessons. FAST is very powerful. It's very simple, and I really want you to be able to understand it, and because if you can understand it, you'll be able to use it, and it will really help you take your performance to the next level. So if you've got any questions, please make sure that you ask them, and we'll try and cover them in the time available. So let me get started. I need to just share my screen now. So I want to start by saying there is no such thing as failure. There is only feedback. And it's what we do with that feedback that will ultimately determine how successful we are. And when we get that feedback, we can look at it and decide, I can't do this, and quit. And quitting really is the only true failure. Or we could just ignore that feedback and try again. But when we do that, we're flirting with madness. Because to do something the same way and to expect a different outcome to the previous times is one of the definitions of madness. Or what we can do is we can learn from that feedback, adjust our approach, and then attack it again. And my FAST approach is going to talk to you about what I've learned from failure and how I've packaged that so that I can use it not only on things I'm trying for a second time, but actually on new endeavors, because the things that cause us to fail are the same in pretty much every single thing that we take on. So one of the reasons I like to talk about this is because I'm very passionate about failure. And I think if we can avoid failures, it's going to put us on that path to success. And I want everybody to be as successful as possible, because I think the more success we have, the better this world will be. So what is it that gives me the authority to talk about failure? I'd like to say it's because of all of the books I've read on the subject, and I've read a lot of books on failure, but really it's not because of that. I'd like to tell you it's because of the hours of research I've done into failure, and I've done thousands of hours, but it's not because of that either. The reason that I'm an expert in failure is because I am a failure. I have failed in more things in more ways than I care to remember. I've delivered projects that should have taken 3 months. I've delivered them 2 years late. I did one project where the budget was 50,000, and we managed to spend a cool 5 million delivering that project. And it's not just professionally that I've experienced failure. I've also experienced it personally as well. One of my biggest passions in life is rugby, and at university, I had the privilege to play for Manchester University, and in my second season, our playing record was 26 played, 26 lost. And even worse, I was the captain. So I have a strong background in failure. This is what got me interested in learning about failure and trying to figure out, were there any common patterns, any common rhythms, anything that I could learn that I would be able to use to avoid future failures. And when I did that, I came up with four key causes of failure. And these are the components that make up FAST. And when I found these four components, I thought, okay, maybe this isn't just prevalent to me. Maybe this has a wider impact. So I started to research failure and I found out a couple of things. The first thing that I found out was that failure is everywhere. IBM says that 60% of all projects fail. 17% fail so badly that if they're of a significant size, and that's usually over 15 million, they can actually almost cause the downfall and bankruptcy of the company. Forbes will tell you that 80% of first-time businesses go bust within 18 months. And according to Fortune magazine, 95% of all product launches fail. So failure is everywhere. And when we fail, it impacts our customers, it impacts our companies, and it also impacts us. Because having a big failure attached to our resume is not going to be very good to help us get a new job. So this is why I'm passionate about it. And when I started to investigate, I found that those four causes of failure that I experienced were prevalent in around 95% of all the instances of failure that I investigated. And as I said, these are the components that make up FAST. And it didn't matter whether the initiative was a multi-billion dollar company, whether it was a solo entrepreneur, or whether it was a personal goal. The reasons for failure are exactly the same. Now, the impact of the failure can be significantly different, but the causes of failure are exactly the same. So I want to talk about what are the reasons for why we fail, and then I'll come on to the causes. So there's two reasons why we fail. And one of the things that Rob said at the start of this is that I keep things simple. So if you're going through this and you're thinking, wow, that sounds too simple to be true, just bear in mind that it's by design. Because if it's simple, you can understand it. And if you can understand it, you can use it. And if you can use it, then you're going to be successful. So I'm trying to keep this as simple as possible so everybody can understand it. And the two reasons as to why we fail are very simple. It's either because we're doing the wrong job or we're doing a poor job. And more often than not, it's because we're doing the wrong job. And when we do the wrong job, it doesn't matter how hard we work, how many hours we put in. When we're doing the wrong job, no matter how well we do it, we are going to fail. And that's just going to lead to frustration and demotivation, not only for us, but also our teams and for our customers. And the things that cause us to do the wrong job are a lack of focus and a lack of accountability. The things that cause us to do a poor job are a lack of simplicity and a lack of transparency. So in my simple way of thinking, if we can improve our performance in our focus, our accountability, our simplicity and transparency, we're going to eliminate many of the common causes of failure. And when we do that, it's going to leave us on the path to success. Now, I've tried this going forward, and I've managed to turn around $100 million projects, $200 million departments, and I've also used it to achieve personal goals like writing books and running marathons. So I know that FAST works, and that if you use it, you'll benefit too. So what I want to do now is quickly go through each of the components of FAST, tell you what it is, talk about what can happen when we lose focus, for example, and then I'm going to give you three tips for how we can improve each of those things. So I'm going to start with focus. So the F of FAST stands for focus. Focus is about our what. Focus is about what does success look like? What's our objective? What's our goal? And we need to be sure that we're focused on the right what. Otherwise, we end up being focused on the wrong things. And when we're focused on the wrong thing, our chance of success is nil. And it doesn't matter how hard we work or how good a job we do. And in many companies that I've worked with, I see people are focused on the wrong what, often without knowing it. And in order to be successful, the managers and the leaders, they just demand more work, longer hours from their teams. But this is just going to be fruitless, because no matter how hard you work, no matter how well you do the wrong job, you're not going to be successful. And not only are you not going to be successful, you're going to end up with a frustrated and demotivated team. And as leaders, it's our job to make sure that we're focused on the right one. Peter Drucker says leadership is about making sure we're doing the right things. Management is about making sure we're doing things right. So it's clearly leadership's responsibility to take that backward step and to make sure that we're focused on the right things. And why are some of the reasons that we lose focus? Well, in today's world, we seem to be under ever-increasing pressure, and it can cause us to just dive in before we fully understand what's needed. And when we do that, our chance of being focused on the wrong thing because we're not clear about what our goal and our objective is significant. One of my favorite quotes from Albert Einstein is that if I had an hour to save the world, I'd spend 55 minutes understanding the problem and then 5 minutes on solving it. And this is because he wants to make sure we're focused on the right thing. Another reason that we can end up focused on the wrong thing is because we end up with too many priorities. And when we've got too many priorities, when everything is a priority, nothing is a priority. I remember in my last job, my boss said to me, "Gordon, these are your 6 number one priorities." But when you have 6 number one priorities, it's not going to work, because at some point you're only going to be able to focus on one thing. And if I don't know which of those things is most important, then there's a good chance I'm going to end up focused on the wrong thing. I'm going to be doing the wrong job, and then all of my hard work is going to lead to nothing. So we need to make sure that we keep our priorities to a minimum, and even then have those priorities so we know what's most important. We also need to make sure that we share our goals and our visions with our teams. A lot of times I find that people are focused on the wrong job because they've been told what to do and not why, and they don't understand the reasoning behind it, or they don't understand all of the details. And a great example of this that I give when I do classes on FAST is that imagine that I'm your boss and I tell the team, "I want to be a millionaire by the time I'm 50. And I send them all off to go and work on it. Now, you might think that they would know what I mean by being a millionaire at 50, but that could mean I want to have $1 million in cash in the bank. It could mean I want a property portfolio of $1 million. It could mean that I want a job with a salary that pays me $1 million. All of those 3 things would be valid answers, but all 3 of them would be different. And if the team has a different perception of what I mean by that, then they're going to be working in different directions, working against each other, thinking they're doing a great job, but ultimately we're going to end up failing. So we need to make sure that we communicate clearly our goal to our teams. Now, I just want to go through a quick failure as an example of what can happen when we don't know what success looks like. This is the SNCF, the French Rail business, and this is a $100 to $150 million failure that they experienced. They were looking to upgrade the trains. They had 384 of the trains delivered ahead of schedule. They were beautiful. They were brilliant. The only problem was they had one minor mistake, and that was these trains were too big. They will not fit through 1,800 of the 2,300 stations that we have in France. So now we've been focused, even though they're beautiful trains, we've been focused on the wrong thing because people didn't know what success looked like. And even worse, this job was about making the trains bigger, but nobody knew how big was too big. And again, when I talk about this impacts your customers, your company, and your career, the, you can imagine how much the people of England, France, Belgium laughed when we heard that the French had made the trains too big. The French even laughed at themselves. They had a cartoon in a local newspaper that said, "Well, the passengers on platform one, please breathe in because your train is now approaching." And also, would you want to be the project manager who has to go to the president of France and say, "You're not going to believe it when I tell you, but it is funny. Trust me, we've made the trains too big." No, of course you wouldn't want to do that, because it's gonna pretty much kill your career. So we need to make sure that we're focused on the right things. And here's three tips. In my book, I have about five or six different tips, but I'm just going to mention three here so that I can give as much value as possible. And these three tips are: we need to make sure that we clarify our goals and objectives clearly. And there's research from Columbia University that says if we can clearly articulate it and write our goal down, we increase our probability of achieving it by 42%. If we share it with our teams, we increase our probability to 78%. So we need to be clear, we need to be able to write them down and share them. We also need to keep our goals to a minimum, ideally no more than three. When I mention this, people say, "There's no way that, you know, my business can have three goals." But when I worked for Henkel, a $20 billion company, 48,000 staff, we had three goals for a three-year period, and we managed to run the company based on that. And then the last thing, we need to communicate the goals clearly, simple, and often, because sometimes things can happen and people might feel that the economic situation or some disaster will change the goals. And if that's the case, then we need to let them know. But if not, we need to keep reminding them these are the goals and they remain the goals, so they stayed focused on them. So that's focus. Do we have any questions on that, Rob?
First one is from Ken, who I know is also in Florida, so not so far away from you. And that's, Gordon, what are your thoughts on lean and agile principles with regards to failure? Fail and fail fast. It seems it's trying to remove the stigma on failure.
Yeah, I like lean and agile, but what I will tell you is that I've spent 30 years working in IT, and I've seen traditional waterfall be successful, and I've seen it fail. I've seen agile be successful, and I've seen agile fail miserably. You know, we need to have a mindset about being able to do things quickly, and we need to get the right people involved in the projects. You know, it's like soccer. A good formation won't turn a bad team into a good team.
And one more question from Anna Maria. How can you be sure your priority or goal is right? What should we ask ourselves to check that?
What does success look like? We define our own success, and we must know what it is we're looking to achieve. So if you can't understand your goal, then you're definitely going to fail. So you need to be very clear, do a lot of soul searching, and understand what your objective is. I would also say if you're not sure, then join a mastermind group, get a mentor, and discuss it with them, because often we do know what our goal is, but we're reluctant to articulate it. And sometimes because it's a fear of success or a fear of being too bold. So now that we know what focus is the what, we're going to talk about accountability. And accountability is about the who. Who is accountable for doing the work? Do they know they're accountable? And is their role and responsibility clear to them? Because often what happens is we fail because it wasn't clear whose job it is to do certain things. We often see in sport where players score and they're completely left unmarked because nobody was sure who it was that was supposed to be marking that person. And we need to make sure that we have clear roles and responsibilities and that we communicate them to our teams. And in a lot of companies, accountability is seen as a bad thing. It's almost as if we're being too aggressive. But if we don't hold people accountable, we're never going to look to make the improvements that we want to. And if you don't like the thought of holding people accountable, then we need to reframe what we mean by accountability. And when I talk about reframe what we mean by holding people accountable. And for me, that's about being clear about what their role and responsibility is, and then reviewing their performance with them. And if they're doing a good job, say, great job, well done, pat on the back. And if it's not going well, say, okay, what can I do to support you? Because as a leader, I'm accountable for the overall success. They're accountable for a small part of it. And together, we're accountable for the success of the initiative. So we need to see it as a supportive approach, not one that's going to be looking at blame and getting into punishment. And in a lot of companies, I see that the boss holds himself accountable, but it needs to be broken down to all levels of the team. In my last job, I had 6 direct reports. And whilst I was accountable overall, my project lead for finance is accountable for finance. The project lead for HR is accountable for HR. And we need to break that accountability down. Let them know what we expect of them. And also let them know that we are accountable overall. So their success is my success. And when you take this approach, you'll see that people start to take ownership. And also with accountability, we cannot delegate accountability. We have to have people accept it. And the way we get people to accept accountability is by making sure that they have the tools, skills, and right authority levels to do the job. Because if they don't have those, then they are never going to accept accountability. You can't make me accountable for something I'm no good at. It won't work. Now, what we can do is we can have a discussion with them where we say, okay, give it your best shot, and then I'll be accountable to try that. But if it's something where I don't have the skills, you cannot force me to be accountable. We have to make sure that we have that conversation of, do you have the right skills, the right tools, the right authority to be able to do this job? Is there anything that's stopping you from being successful? And when they say no, now they've accepted accountability and we're going to be able to get them to move forward. With accountability as well, we need to hold people accountable for outcomes, not following process, because if the process fails, then they're going to blame the process and they're going to feel that they successfully followed it. And I'll give you an example of that. I was working in Germany, and we'd had 5 days of torrential rain in June. The rain was standing about 6 inches deep as I was driving into the office. And as I got there, I drove past the guy from the local council, and he was stood in Wellington boots in 6 inches of water, and he was watering plants that were in 6 inches of water. The last thing these plants needed was more water. They were nearly drowning. And when I got to the office, I said to the guys, please explain to me what the hell is going on there. And they said, it's the rule in Germany. If the temperature's over 30 degrees, you have to water the plants. So if these plants die, you can't blame the guy from the council because he was following orders. He was following the rule. What we should do is hold him accountable for outcomes. And if we do that, then he's probably not going to water those plants at all. He's probably going to find a way to try and drain some of the water off. So need to make sure that we hold people accountable for outcomes, not following process. And also with accountability, we need to remember that as leaders, when we're looking for somebody to blame, if you're not sure whose fault it is when something's going wrong in your team, get a mirror. Because we are accountable. It's our area. We are ultimately accountable. And accountability starts with us. If it doesn't start with us, then we will not be able to create a culture of accountability. My last boss was always telling people, you need to be on time for meetings. You need to be on time for meetings. And he was always 5 to 10 minutes late. And I can tell you, with that role model example, nobody ever turned up on time. So if you want people to be accountable, then as a leader, you have to be accountable and be that role model. So what I want to do now is just give you a quick example of what can happen when we lose accountability. This is a 125 million euro failure. This is the Mars Climate Orbiter. This was from about 7 or 8 years ago. And this was the first weather satellite to measure the weather on another planet. They sent it up to Mars. It went into orbit, and as it started to come down to settle into its static orbit where it would record the weather over Mars, it just disappeared from the systems, burnt up in the atmosphere, and was never seen again. And the reason why this happened was because there were two different teams that were working on an area that overlapped. We had one team that was designing the software that controlled the engines, and we had a different team who were doing the calculations for the navigation and the amount of thrust that the engines needed. And the problem here was that one team was working in the metric system, so centimeters, kilos, liters, and the other team was working in the imperial system, pounds, feet, inches, pints. And what happened? They got data that was conflicting and sent the spaceship into a below where it should have been safe, and it burnt up, and that cost $125 million. And this was all because two different teams didn't know what each other was doing. So instead of working collaboratively together, they ended up working against each other, which resulted in a €125 million loss. Not only did it result in a loss, after this fiasco, it actually caused the funding to NASA to be significantly reduced. I mean, if we can't trust you to get the measurements right for $125 million, why would we give you more money? And also, as the project manager, do you want to be going to the head of NASA and saying, sit down, you're going to laugh when I tell you this, but we had two different teams, one working in feet, the others working in centimeters, and we've lost €125 million satellite. No, because at the end of that, your probability of getting another job is going to be pretty low. So we need to make sure that we get accountability right. And a lot of methodologies talk about a lot of the other things I'm going to talk about, but accountability is key. And the way to improve accountability, here's three tips for you. One, we need to have clear roles and responsibility with expectation, and we need to communicate those roles to our teams. Now, it doesn't need to be massively detailed down to the nth degree, but it does need to be sufficient detail that they'll understand. And we need to hold people accountable for outcomes, not following process, because when we do that, we empower them to be able to make changes if they don't think they're going to deliver the result or the outcome that we're looking for. And then lastly, we need to be accountable ourselves. Accountability starts with us. Leadership defines culture. And if the more accountable you are, the more accountable your teams are going to be. And if you're an entrepreneur and you're dealing and you don't really have a team, even being accountable yourself, it also models the behavior that you expect from your customers and your suppliers. And when you exhibit that role, quite often they will follow suit and they will match your behavior. So be accountable. That's the number one thing we need to do in order to boost accountability.
Couple of questions and a three-part question in from Anna Maria, which is relevant to quite a lot of people who I can see watching us this evening, Gordon. A lot of people in project environments. I recognize a lot of the names. So the first part of the question is, why do you think today's companies avoid using accountability? And why is blame and guilt still better in their opinion?
Being brutally honest, accountability starts with me. And if I don't want to be held accountable, the best thing for me to do is to create a blame culture. So I think a lot of times people don't want to turn the spotlight on themselves, because what I've found when I've looked at why people are failing, and you're going, why are you failing? What are you doing wrong? Blah, blah, blah. And you go and you speak to them, you find out that one, you haven't given them clear direction. Two, you haven't given them the tools they need to do the job. Three, you've picked the wrong person because they don't have the skills. And then four, maybe, just maybe, they had everything they needed and they just chose not to do it. And more often than not, it's one of those first three. So I think the reason why people prefer blame to accountability is because it makes them have to live up to their part in the failure. I mean, if my team fails, it's my fault.
A third part of that question from Anna Maria was, how do you persuade your manager that they should be holding people more accountable?
That's a great question. I think sometimes we just have to challenge them. I mean, I can honestly say that my last boss, who was late to every single meeting, I did ask him why he was late, and he actually told me it was because his time was more valuable than mine, so it didn't matter. So, you know, it's very difficult to tell managers what they need to do. But, you know, you could try and have that discussion with them to say, look, you know, leadership defines culture. So if you want a culture of accountability, it has to start with you. We can't have a do as I say, not as I do culture. But, you know, that is a difficult conversation to have. There's a great book called Leadership and Self-Deception from Abinger Press. I would probably buy them that as a Christmas present or birthday present and tell them it's the best leadership book I've ever read. Because after you read that book, it leaves you in no doubt as to your role in the involvement in failure. So then the next part of FAST is simplicity. So focus and accountability. Focus is about the what. Accountability is about the who. And when we've got the right person doing the right job, this allows us to increase our effectiveness. And effectiveness is all about making progress towards our goal. What we now need to do is we need to increase our efficiency so that we can make the progress towards our goal quicker. So it's effectiveness first, then efficiency. And simplicity is one of the two key components for increasing our efficiency. And simplicity is about the how. How are we going to do the work we intend? And have we kept it as simple as possible? Do we have the simplest approach? Because if we do, then it's going to allow us to be able to make progress and do it as efficiently as possible. If we've got a complex approach or a more complex, that is going to impact our ability to be as efficient as possible. And in this world, we have a natural tendency to overcomplicate things. And whilst a lot of people might think that's a result of modern life and all of the technology and always on culture that we're moving towards, I just need to remind you of a saying that says, life is simple, but it's complicated by man. And that was a saying from Confucius. So this is not a new phenomenon. For the past 1,000, 2,000 years, we've had this natural tendency to overcomplicate things. And one of the reasons for that is because sometimes we want to show our expertise. And if you've got a physicist, a chemist, a biologist, and you ask them to solve a problem, they're going to come up with a physics solution, a chemistry solution, or a biology solution, one that's from their area of expertise, rather than potentially picking the simplest solution. Or it could be people are worried about losing their job, so they'll come up with a complex solution in order to make themselves more necessary going forward. And we have to challenge this. We have to be constantly looking for the simplest solutions. And when it comes to experts who are masters at overcomplicating things, we need to remind them when we ask them to explain things that Einstein says, if you cannot explain it to an 8-year-old, you don't understand it. So we cannot let people tell us, oh, you know, I worked with network engineers and I know nothing about networking. You know, I cannot allow them to tell me, oh, this is too complicated. It's not your area of expertise. You'll never understand it. Actually, I don't have to. It's your area of expertise. And I need you to find a way to explain it so that I can understand. And if your experts can't explain it, then they don't understand it. And if they don't understand it, you don't want them coming up with a solution for your team, because it's probably going to be the wrong solution. And now we're going to be looking at doing the wrong job and failing. Or if they can't explain it clearly, how are we going to be able to delegate that work to our teams so that they can do it efficiently and effectively? And as I say, we have a natural tendency to overcomplicate things. And I recognized this very early in my career. I was about 17 when, and this was, I'll tell you how long ago this was, Bjorn Borg hadn't won his first Wimbledon at this point. This was 1976, the hottest summer on record for a long time in England. And my dad's boss, who has a degree in electrical engineering, the guy was an absolute genius. He wanted to book a trip to a holiday cottage in France. And in those days, there's no internet, there's no cell phones, there's no email. The only way to do it is to write a letter. And now you're relying on both the British Postal Service and the French. Probably not a good move back in the 70s. or you could phone them. And my dad's boss chose to go down the telephone route, but he also decided that his French wasn't good enough to be able to do this. And he was telling my dad, and my dad said, well, Gordon's studying French, he'll be able to help you out. So they called me in for a fee and asked me to give the call. And my dad's boss said to me, look, I want to book the first 2 weeks in August. Is your French good enough to do that? And I went, yep, not a problem. And he said, I want to know, are there any special circumstances or anything that I need to know in order to stay there and have a great time? And I said, yep, I can do all of that. So my dad's boss dialed the number in France, handed me the phone. And when the person said hello, I said, parlez-vous anglais? And the guy said, of course I speak English. And I said, great, could I book the first 2 weeks in August? My dad's boss was livid because it never occurred to him that the people who were advertising in a magazine written in English, advertising holiday cottages for people in England, could speak English. He just made that assumption. They live in France. They speak fluent French. My French isn't good enough. Now I have a problem. And this is a guy with a degree in electrical engineering. So we do have this natural tendency to overcomplicate things and sometimes see things more difficult than they are. And we need to make sure that we fight against this, because when we have that complexity, it can impact our ability to achieve what we're looking for. In my experience, people are not afraid of hard work. They're afraid of failure. And if they cannot see how they're going to be successful, then why work hard at all? If I have a choice between failing through sitting next to the pool sipping pina coladas or failing by working really, really hard, then I'm going to take the opportunity to fail sat by the pool. And I don't think I'm different to other people. So we need that simplicity so people can see how they're going to be able to be successful and then can apply the hard work. And I'll give you an example of this, a personal one. And that was when I decided to run my first marathon at the age of 52, my two best friends said to me, Gordon, you're too fat, you're too old, you're too unfit, forget it. Why not start with something like a 5K? Don't even think about a marathon. You'll never be able to do it. And I said to him, well, guys, I've got a plan. And it's a very simple plan. I've downloaded the Virgin Marathon Beginner's Training Plan. And it starts with day one, run for 15 minutes. And they said, yep, you could do that. And I said, well, day two, it's run for 15 minutes. And they said, well, yeah, you could do that as well. And I said, well, day three is run for 10, walk for 5, run for 10, and then next day run for 15, take Saturday off, and on Sunday run for 20 minutes. And they said, yeah, you could do that. I said, well, the second week is run for 20 minutes every day, take Saturday off, and then run for 25. And they said, well, yeah, if you've done week one and you do week two, you'll be able to do run the 25. And I said, well, that's the whole premise of this planet. It's a wash, rinse, repeat process. Every week you increase the distance, and on Saturday you take Saturday off, and on Sunday you run 5 to 10 minutes longer. And if you do that for 24 weeks, you're going to be running for 4.5 hours, which is enough to do a marathon. And my two best friends looked at me and said, wow, we'll run it with you. And this was because they now could see how we were going to be successful. They even knew it was going to be a lot of hard work, because we still got to run 26 miles. We're probably going to have to run over 200 miles in training. But they could see how we were going to be successful. And when we get that belief, it's belief that gives us the confidence. And confidence is one of the key indicators of whether we will be successful or not. So we need to keep things simple in order to be able to create that belief so that people can see how they're going to be successful and then give it 200%. Also, as well, another thing with simplicity is that we, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, we all need a feeling of esteem, of self-esteem. We want to know that we've done a good job. And often if things are complicated, we'll actually find other jobs to do jobs that are not related to our goal so that we can be successful. And then we go home feeling good about what we've done. I've seen it myself. My wife, she has something important to do, but she'll go and clean the house because she feels great about that. She's put off doing what was important, but she's done something. So we need to make sure that we look at everything. And if people get dragged on to doing these secondary tasks that don't move us forward, we need to eliminate those and pull them out. So I want to give you a quick example of what can happen when we lose our simplicity. And Albert Einstein said, in addition to if you can't explain it to an eight-year-old, you don't understand it, he also said we should make things as simple as possible and no simpler. And the reason for that is because when we make things too simple, we're in danger of making them more complicated. And this example here is a great example of oversimplification leading to complication. And this was a $5 billion failure. This is the US Army. They wanted to go with what they call their unicam, multicam camouflage. They wanted one camouflage that would work everywhere instead of having the separate desert, mountain, forest, and snow camouflage. And as you can see from the image, instead of going from one camouflage that worked everywhere, they ended up with one camouflage that worked nowhere. And this was a $5 billion fiscal loss. Not only that, the army was ridiculed by the other units, and you've put your staff at risk. The last two conflicts for America have been in Afghanistan and Iraq, and these outfits are predominantly green and gray, and Iraq and Afghanistan are brown. So you've now put your troops in a color that makes them stick out like a sore thumb, all because we tried to overcomplicate too much. So we need to simplify, but we need to make sure that we don't go that one step too far, because we can end up making it more complex. And the three things we need to do to increase simplicity: one is we need to challenge our teams to keep it as simple as possible. And I always tell the story of NASA and the pen. NASA wanted to, they had trouble with a ballpoint pen that would work in zero gravity, so they got the pen designers. Allegedly, they spent $1 billion and came up with a pen that would work. The Russians, they use a pencil. Now, it's not a true story, but it's a great learning tool. And tell your teams that, and then every time you come up with something, ask them what would be the pencil solution. And then what we need to do is we need to challenge everything. There's a lot of processes that are historical. We need to review them. And if I ever hear the phrase, "we've always done it that way," for me, that's a clear sign of something that we need to rip out and review, because it's probably adding no value and we're just wasting our time doing it. And then lastly, the Pareto, what I call the Pareto approach, and that is, imagine you've only got 20% of the time available. If you've only got 20% of the time available, how would you deliver 100% of what you've got planned? And that makes you start to think about what's important and what you could eliminate. And when you do that, it's going to allow you to simplify the process and allow you to make more progress and be more efficient. So these are the things that are going to allow you to be more simple.
There's a comment from Jason stating simplifying is what lean is all about. Remove all the waste.
Absolutely. But sometimes it's not just about eliminating the waste. Sometimes it's just about making sure we've gone with the easiest problem. One of the challenges I've seen with lean, and I love lean, is that we can end up trying to fix the wrong process. So first of all, make sure you're following the right approach and then apply lean to that approach.
IT and software projects are normally quite difficult situations to insist on simplicity. What would be the turnaround questions that could be used to make people see that simplicity is most important in those kind of environments?
Well, I think we have to understand what simplicity is. Within IT, my experience was that we tended to make it as simple as possible for the IT department, and that ended up making it more complex for the end user. So, you know, simplicity is about making it simpler for the end user, and nothing is impossible. I mean, you look at Apple software is, and I know there's Sebastian on the line who's probably having kittens when I say this, but, you know, Apple software is very simple and straightforward to use. You know, the computer comes, you get it out of the box, you turn it on. Everything's possible, but you have to take a simplicity mindset. You need people who've been trained in lean, because once you get that mindset, you're always looking for opportunities to improve. So T stands for transparency. So focus is about the what, simplicity, accountability is about the who, simplicity is about the how, and transparency is about how far. How far have we gone? How far do we have to go? And transparency is about truth and knowledge. It's about the knowledge of what's fully involved, because according to Gartner, projects end up costing 3 times the original estimate because we underestimated what was involved. So we need to make sure we have a full visibility into what's needed. And then we need truth and accuracy as to our actual performance. There's no point in lying to ourselves. And I've seen this a lot in IT, where we get project status reports and people will say, oh, my project status is green. And you start to dig and there's no real metrics or proof around this. It's just a gut feeling. People want to be, you know, positive about that, but that doesn't help us. We need data-driven metrics, and there's tons of data available. You know, there's staffing reports with the number of hours spent. There's cost reports, sales reports, finance reports. We need to make sure that as much real-time data is used as possible in order to understand where we are. And if I was going to go on a diet to lose 10 kilos in 10 months, I wouldn't email you and tell you how I was feeling. You'd want me in your office Monday morning, get on the scales. Let's understand what your start point was. Let's look at where we think you should be in month 2, month 3, month 4. And then let's look and see how you are today. Are you on track? Yes or no? Because if we lack that transparency, it's like we're running a race blindfold. And after 5 minutes, we've no idea where we are, we've no idea where our competition is, we've no idea where the finishing line is, and yet somehow we think that magically we're going to win. Doesn't work like that. We need to have transparency into our performance. And I'll give you an example. My fourth marathon, I'd run my first three in 5 hours 12, 5 hours 2, 5 hours 15, and I ran the Athens Marathon, and I decided this was the marathon I was going to run in under 5 hours. The original, we ran from marathon, finished in the Olympic Stadium. I knew all of the times I needed to be at, and I set off, and after 4.5 hours, I was ahead of schedule, and it was slightly downhill, so I thought, this is great, I'm bang on schedule. I'm going to achieve my goal of running it under 5 hours. And then what happened was my iPhone battery died. And my iPhone was telling me how fast I was going. And bear in mind, at this point, I'm starting to lose energy. I'm starting to lose momentum. It was telling me how fast I was going, how long I've been running for, and how much further I had to go. And when that battery died, I lost complete visibility into my performance, and I ended up crossing the finishing line in five hours and 9 seconds. I managed to pluck defeat from the jaws of victory because I just didn't have transparency into my overall performance. That I could have easily found another 9 seconds. I could have skipped the coffee and croissant at Starbucks with 15 minutes ago. There are lots of places, but I failed by 9 seconds because I didn't have transparency and visibility into my performance. And we need that so that we can then hold our teams accountable, tell them good job, well done if they're on track. If not, we can look and see what we need to improve in order to make the goals that we need to achieve. So transparency is crucially important. Here's a transparency fair. I'm going to go quickly through this so we can get to the end and do some more questions. This is a transparency failure that comes from 1977. This was Star Wars. This was Kenner Toys who won the contract to make the Star Wars action figures. This had never been done before. They had no view on how big Star Wars was going to be. They expected Star Wars to gross 20 million, which would have been, well, they expected to gross 15 million, which would have been just below 2001, which was the biggest grossing sci-fi movie of all time at that point. And they thought that the action figures might be quite well. So they had the production facility set up. And what happened was Star Wars grossed $285 million. It was a huge monumental success, and yet Kenner Toys never adjusted this information into their processing. And what happened was at Christmas, when this became the number one must-have toy, they couldn't meet production. They hadn't scaled up to meet the demand. And they ended up giving away empty boxes with vouchers in that said, as soon as we've made enough toys, you'll now get one. And this cost them tens of millions, around about 30 million at the time, I believe, was the number mentioned, all because they didn't understand how big this was going to be. And that's understandable, but they didn't react. The movie came out in May. They had plenty of warning that this was going to be the biggest movie ever at the time and that they should adjust production, but they didn't do that. And that caused them to fail to meet the demand and cost them tens of millions of dollars in money. So three quick tips to increase our transparency. We need to make sure we've done the due diligence. That means lifting the lid, looking under the hood, imagining that we only know one third, and investigating until we believe we've uncovered everything. We need to create a plan of what our progress is, so we kind of have like a GPS. We know on every stage of the journey where we're going to be, so that we can then track our performance. And if we're on track, great. If not, we can adjust it. And then we need to communicate our progress regularly to our teams, because it's great for them to be able to see where we are. It allows us to hold them accountable. And also, when you see that you're making the progress or you're ahead of schedule, it's great for motivation. So that's transparency. I'll finish with the wrap up, then we'll get to the questions on transparency and all of it. So focus and accountability. This is what allows us to ensure that we're doing the right job, that we allows us to be effective. Simplicity and transparency, doing well in those, is what allows us to be efficient. And when we are both effective and efficient, this is what allows us to achieve excellence. And excellence isn't the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. It's not Lionel Messi. That's brilliance. And we don't want to be talking about brilliance, because brilliance is difficult to achieve. But excellence is just about doing the right job well every single time. And we are all capable of doing that. So when you go back to your office or log out of this webinar, I want you to ask yourself the four questions. Am I focused on the right things? Do I have the right level of accountability? Do I know who's involved? Am I accountable? Have I communicated it? Is my plan as simple as possible? Do my team believe that we're going to be successful? Because research shows that on projects that fail, 75% of the time, the team knew they were going to fail before they started. So it's good to check that they understand and believe that they're going to be successful. And then lastly, do I have the right transparency? Do I know what's completely involved? When you run a marathon, it's not about running 26 miles on the day of the race. It's about running 300 miles in training. It's about running 5 days a week. If you can't sign up for that, you're not going to be successful at running a marathon. And then, do we have a GPS? Do you have a plan of your actual progress that you can track your progress again? And if you have all of those things, you are going to put yourself in a position where you're going to eliminate failure, or the majority of it, and that's going to leave you to be successful. So that's FAST. I've used it to run marathons, write books, run projects, run departments, and it's allowed me to turn them around and create success. It's allowed me to build my social media following of over 400,000. So FAST works, and I know that it will work for you.
Really interesting, the nature of the questions which are coming in, all kind of referring to people's managers and leaders. So the first question we've got is,
Before you ask that, can I just go back and say, if you've got a manager that needs to be more accountable, I can't believe I didn't say this, buy them a copy of FAST and give it to them.
That's a good solution. I'll just read a question from Chris. So it seems as if Chris is an independent consultant. When you know the client has decided on the wrong strategy, but they want it implemented, how do you deal with that?
So there's a couple of things you can do. One is you can take the moral high ground and say, I quit. But, you know, unfortunately, mortgages need to be paid, food needs to be purchased. So we don't all have the luxury of that. But one of the things I would do is I would take the FAST approach. I would try and discuss with them the focus, and, you know, maybe get a review of the approach to see whether it's going to result in success. And if if they're not open to that, then we need to make sure that we have the right transparency. Because my approach to losing 10 kilos in 10 weeks is to eat 5 donuts a day. And I don't care what the nutritionists say. I believe that that's going to work. But if we have a transparency into what my progress should be, and we measure that, and we don't see that we're making any progress at all, it's at this point that you can question the approach. So you have to measure its effectiveness. And when it's not being effective, that's the point at which you can challenge it and possibly suggest an alternative approach.
From Anna Maria, do you think the plan for progress to achieve transparency should be detailed to the level of the employee?
No, I don't think so. You know, I worked for Henkel, and our objective was to hit 14% EBIT. We measured that at a company level. Now, so the CEO showed where we were overall in terms of progress, which allowed us to communicate, you know, what the goal was and how we were doing. But you do need to let people understand how it's going to. Yeah, you probably need to be measuring it, not necessarily down to employee, but it does need to be down at a function or at a team level. Because if you're just measuring, you know, one of the case studies I show is we used to have on-time delivery of 35%. And because we didn't measure that by team and we had 6 teams involved, it was very easy for each team to point the finger at another team. So we broke it down to the 6 teams and then got each team to improve. We didn't necessarily do it right down to the individual, but we did do it down to individual teams. The more granular that you have the transparency, the better the results are going to be. And I think what you'll find is when you implement it, you will, and you see the benefits, you will take it down to a lower level and one that feels right for you. And the good thing about transparency is what allows us to hold people accountable.
I've thrown up a link to the Amazon site with where a copy of your book can be purchased. If you want to say anything about that.
Yeah, if you'd like a signed copy, you could contact me. But given the postal rates from the US, it's actually cheaper to buy it on Amazon. So let's keep it as simple as possible. Just go on and pick it up off of Amazon. And bear in mind, Amazon is not a simple company. If you're living in Europe and you log on to Amazon.com, they will send one to you from the US. So you need to log on to the Amazon for your region so that you don't end up paying excessive shipping fees.
Right. Thank you very much, everybody, for joining us. And thank you, Gordon, for presenting to us.
It was my absolute pleasure. And please use FAST. It will make you more successful.
You have just listened to another episode of CXOFM with Rob Llewellyn. To discover how to transform your business for more benefits, return on investment, and competitive advantage, visit cxoweekly.com. From there, you can enjoy the value and convenience of the finest curated collection of business transformation, innovation, and digital content for transformation leaders.